fantastic, and I think there were so many interesting discussions, both, you know, during the talks and after the talks, and then outside over coffee and late at night, and I think it's been really fantastic. And I think, one of our hopes was that this would generate some new ideas, like, during the conference. It wouldn't just be people telling about the ideas they had before they came to the conference, and at least from my humble perspective, you know, of course, it takes some time to let the ideas percolate to see what happens, comes from them, but I think there's definitely been a lot of interesting new ideas that have been generated that we need to, that is homework for us all to go back to our institutions or our offices if we're nearby and think about, which is really, really exciting. Thought I should start with a little story, since maybe you've caught on that I like to tell stories. And I was thinking of, you know, really, one of the giants of physics that I hold in such high esteem, Michael Faraday, who I feel some connection with because as a graduate student, my work was on nonlinear Faraday rotation. So I thought, you know, it's just this continuation of this path that Faraday started back in the 1800s. And, you know, I'd just been reading a year ago this fantastic biography of Faraday, and just, you know, he's even more amazing than I thought he was before I read the biography. And I thought too that that's a great example of theory and experiment getting together, because Maxwell, of course, you know, was younger, quite a bit younger than Faraday, but he came to Faraday and people had kind of been ignoring him a little. I mean, he obviously had done a great job, but then discovered so many things. But it was really Maxwell that came and read very carefully all of Faraday's amazing, you know, experimental work, and then from that he was able to formulate the complete theory of electromagnetism, which of course stands still today as one of the great achievements of both theoretical and experimental physics working hand in hand. I had been read this book, and I've been telling my kids about how great Faraday was and how difficult these experiments used to be, because they couldn't see things on an oscilloscope or typing a computer. You know, when Faraday had to measure voltage, he had to put the things to his tongue and find out, that was a high voltage. Or, it's like, experimental physics used to be a contact sport. So one day after kindergarten, my daughter comes home with two black eyes. And I'm like, Paloma, of course, I've been trying to convince both my daughters, how great physics is, and they should be physicists, it'll be so fantastic. And, I dream, sometime in 30 years, we'll reconvene one of these conferences, and, they'll be here too, giving talks, it'll be great. But so she comes home, and she's got two black eyes. I'm like, Paloma, well, what happened? And she's like, oh, Dad, it was great. I did an experiment. I was like, oh, well, great. So what happened? And she's like, well, I told all of my friends, stand back, everybody get back. I'm going to do an experiment. So there was a big tire in the middle of the playground, and she took a shovel and she put it on the tire, and then she put a bucket on the end of the shovel, and then she jumped on the shovel and shot the bucket into her face. And she tells a story. She said, "I was just like Michael Faraday," which I thought was fantastic, because not only did she try to do an experiment, but what confidence! I mean, she jumped on a shovel and put a bucket into her head, and now she's Michael Faraday. So, I was very proud of her for her confidence. And I think she set some limits, actually, on gravitational coupling to orbital motion, but I don't think they rule out any of the experiments we've been proposing. So with that, I think, really, Michael Faraday had a great summary for this conference. One of his things he liked to say was, "But still try, for who knows what is possible." And I think that's a good way to summarize the conference. So that's pretty much the end of my summary. But I did, we do have a couple of experts on LIGO who I thought would be, had a few things to say, because LIGO has been brought up in several different contexts throughout the talk. And I think Josh Smith had a few things to say from the LIGO collaboration that might be of interest to the community. So he has a couple slides. And then I have, I'm going to lead a discussion question quiz on the conference after that. So,
tell another story while I'm plugging in.
Oh, I got a million of them. Yeah, sure.
Oh, actually, I have to see if I have a plug thing.
Is this thing?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. My name is Josh Smith, and Chris Pankow is the other LIGO person that has been referred to a few times. So we're invited because we're working. I work in the Cal State system. I'm at Cal State Fullerton. Derek is at East Bay. So we've had a chance to meet that way, and I've met a few of you this week, and I've been involved with some of the work that has been shown. But I wanted to give a quick update on where LIGO is. It's actually a pretty exciting time. The first slide I was going to show is just for any newcomers in the audience to the science that LIGO is trying to do. We're trying to measure stretching and squeezing of space-time caused by different astronomical sources. So we have things that are short duration and well-modeled, like two black holes or neutron stars go around each other, give off energy to gravitational waves, and eventually coalesce. We're looking also for things like supernova explosions, which are probably weaker. We can only see those in the galaxy. They happen a little less often. Spinning, non-axisymmetric sources, and then stochastic sources like the early universe. We saw a ton of really great experimental talks this week, and I was impressed with a lot of them, and I was also impressed to see a lot of the ingenuity that had overcome some of the technical limits to sensitivity. I think we have a lot to learn in that sense. In the 90s, we already knew what things would limit LIGO's sensitivity. So this is a basic Michelson interferometer with a laser and a beam splitter and two long Fabry-Perot cavities. So we knew that seismic motion of the ground was going to be a limitation at low frequencies. We only suspended the mirrors as single pendulums. So for initial LIGO, which ended in about 2010, there was a wall of seismic noise below about 40 hertz. At the intermediate frequency range, so down is more sensitive here. This is the gravitational wave strain, delta L over L. And thermal noise limits over the intermediate frequency range. That's thermal noise of the molecules in the mirrors in this case. So this is thermal noise of the mirrors and to some extent their coating, and then shot noise of the laser at higher frequencies. So over the last several years, even before that, from 2010 until now, we've been kind of dark. So the LIGO interferometers haven't been operating. We've been upgrading to advanced LIGO. The changes there with respect to those single pendulums, we've gone to quadruple pendulums. So you get at best 1 over f squared filtering for each additional pendulum stage. So this gives us a much sharper a roll-off of seismic noise. And this has also been pushed down. The resonance frequency has been pushed down to lower frequencies, making the pendulums longer. And there are three stages of active seismic isolation. So I know some of you from Stanford here, a bunch of the people at Stanford worked on this upgrade to applying active seismic isolation before these suspensions. There's tiered control, and also the mirrors are much bigger to reduce radiation pressure from the light. So to reduce quantum noise from radiation pressure at lower frequencies. To reduce thermal noise, we've been basically getting higher Q materials for using fused silica for the entire suspension. The suspension used to be suspended on piano wire, and now it's we use lasers to make fused silica fibers between the lowest stage where the mirror is actually and the stage just above it, and everything's connected together monolithically, which increases the quality factor because we make our resonances for the most part out of the band. So increasing the quality factor brings down the off resonance thermal noise by kind of, if you could think of it like confining more of the thermal motions in the resonance. And we also have larger mirrors because the larger the mirror size allows us to average over the thermal fluctuations of the coating and the mirror surface, which is one of the main noise sources. And then the third type of noise that we attacked was quantum noise. So that's both shot noise and radiation pressure noise. So we installed a laser that was roughly 10 times as powerful as the initial LIGO laser. And we also used DC readout and signal recycling as two techniques to increase the signal to noise ratio. And the higher frequency regime, we've demonstrated in GEO 600 and LIGO that this noise in the long interferometers can be reduced with squeezed light, and there are plans to use squeezed light to reduce quantum noise broadband as an upgrade to LIGO. So that can be done in a frequency dependent way so that you can reduce both radiation pressure noise and shot noise by using a filter cavity to create frequency dependent squeezing. This is some data that I stole from the logbook and made a like by hand drawing of. So this is the thing I really wanted to tell you. A couple weeks ago, the LIGO Livingston, the first advanced LIGO detector, has come online. So the folks there have been working really hard installing. It's installed. It locks up to hours now. They're making it more robust and building in the automatic alignment and everything. But basically, essentially the day it turned on, or within a week of turning it on, it was doing almost as good as initial LIGO. And initial LIGO, from the time we turned it on until it did as good as this, took 5 years. So this is a great starting point for us. I think it's a really great place for the field to be in, because I think folks feel pretty confident about getting. Starting to get the noise hunting underway and starting to get this curve going down so we can do measurements. LIGO Hanford is in the last stages of installation, so by the end of the summer, things should be coming together. And you're probably wondering about the prospects for detection and the schedule. And so we have this publicly available document. So the last one I'm probably maybe, you know, questionably could get in trouble for showing you, so forget you saw that. But this one is our public-facing document about the schedule. And so in 2015, we plan to already be doing a 3-month science run. There are probably going to be some shorter engineering runs before that where we test things out. And these curves here give you an indication of how the sensitivity is going to progress. So initial LIGO was somewhere around here. And the current curve that I showed from just turning on is somewhere around here. So we think in 2015 we'll be somewhere around this blue curve. And then it's just going to progress. The runs are going to get longer. The range to some standard sources like binary neutron stars are going to get larger. And so as you go through the different years, we add other detectors like Virgo in India. And these are the kind of rates that we expect from the pessimistic to somewhat optimistic, with realistic kind of being in the center there. And I've also seen this shown as like a chance for detection. This is based primarily on binary neutron star in spirals. That's the source that we have the best handle on. And so the numbers get, you know, above one or closer to one even for the pessimistic rate as the years go forward. But we think already in 2015 we'll be doing good science. So, okay, sorry. That's, I don't know if we have any questions about that, or wasn't a real talk. That's it.
So you expect to reach this sensitivity? That's the bottom line. Everything seems to be working fine. That's the bottom line that you're telling.
Oh well, it was just turned on. Yeah. So I think the bottom line for it just being turned on is that. It's pretty good considering that everything just kind of got bolted in place and things were turned on. There were some engineering things that happened, like testing single arm cavities and testing suspensions and things like that. And I think all of that work on the design and engineering and preliminary tests put us in a really good spot for turning on, where the folks at the detectors don't have as much noise to find, nearly as much noise to find and get rid of as we did in initial LIGO. Mm-hmm.
So the first science publication, we should expect it to come out when, like in 2 years?
So I think there are actually some schedules about that on here. So like within the collaboration, we have all these milestones. So anytime we reach an increase in sensitivity by some factor, we expect to do some run and write a publication about it. I think there should be science coming out of the runs that we do in 2015. But maybe not for every source, because for the sources where we've made a big improvement on or detection.
Yeah.
So what would happen? You showed this noise. What would happen that it would settle down or it would go down? What happens?
Right. So what happens over the years here are people find and eliminate sources of technical noise in the detectors. The laser power, we're originally starting with a somewhat lower laser power to get to know the system and to get everything into its low noise configuration in the kind of low frequency band. Eventually, the laser power is going to be turned up. Systems are going to be tuned. So it's something that we call commissioning. So basically, it's finding and identifying sources of technical noise, removing them, tuning all of your systems, tuning all of your control loops, turning up the laser power. I mean, probably that description doesn't do it justice, but we've found with these big interferometers that it takes some time to get to the design sensitivity.
Just out of my curiosity, so it's going to be a laser run 24/7, and it's going to deliver how much power, and what's the type of the laser?
It's a YAG laser, so it's 1064 nanometers, neodymium YAG. It is developed by the Laser Centrum Hannover and the University of Hannover. 200 watts is its nominal power, usually runs at about 180. I wonder if I possibly even have something in here about it. I could show you schematics of the different amplifiers and pumping and all that kind of stuff, but I don't have it right on hand.
It's probably also worth noting that it'll be about 10,000 watts of power circulating in the arcs.
Yeah, so there's a laser that's 200 watts, but then there's power recycling. There's a Michelson interferometer that looks like a mirror when it's held at the dark fringe, so we use power recycling mirror to build up as a cavity there. Both arms have Fourier Pro cavities, so there's thousands of times buildup. Okay, shouldn't steal any more of Derek's time.
Oh, not my time.
All right.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Back to the stories.
Oh, yeah, right. All right, so that was our LIGO update. So my plan to continue the summary is an end of conference quiz and oral exam. So I think as with, probably we've all had professors like this, probably most of these questions have no answer. But I think hopefully to stimulate discussion and keep it going and maybe guide us along. So I tried to go through all of my notes on all of the talks and tried my best to identify some topics that people were kind of discussing and maybe thinking about, but maybe got cut off because we're moving on to the next talk, and now we're at the end of the conference, and our chance to go back and hit them. And I tried to organize them roughly in some sort of order and group them together, but we can just go through them and take breaks as necessary, and then also get other questions, and don't feel obliged to follow this outline. If we get something even more interesting, we should go for it. So question number one, I think to kind of put things into perspective, I think we had, amazing talks from the theorists and experimentalists about creative ideas and very strict limits and different motivations, different things. So trying to figure out the lay of the land in terms of where, the most interesting new physics are. Well, maybe one way to phrase it, I don't know if it's a good philosophy or not. Actually, it's very pessimistic. I'm usually very optimistic, but this is kind of flipping the conference on its head, right? So the question is, are there, given the possibility of boring answers to all of these great mysteries of physics that we're all confronting, of course, it's more interesting from the experimental standpoint to ask, oh, is there some clever theory that gives you something within the range of experiment? That's all very exciting, and that motivates us to go out and look for things. But if you flip it on its head and say, well, can you find plausible, reasonable, that are, reasonably acceptable boring solutions that don't give access to experiments? If you do that for most of the problems that you can, my question, I guess, is what's left? Like, what are the problems in theory that you can't get rid of even with that would lead to new physics observable at some level that we can't just eliminate? So I heard talk of, for example, right, that if a cosmological constant is the thing that's driving the accelerating expansion of the universe, then you know, it could be hard to detect with laboratory. I mean, that wouldn't give you anything in a laboratory experiment. And also, it seems possible that the dark matter has no couplings beyond gravity to standard model particles. It doesn't seem that that's, as far as I understand, not certainly not implausible, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know what else. Like, you know, so yeah. So I mean, one question would be like, what are the problems in theory that like, ah, no matter what you do, something spurting out into experimental landscape. I don't know. So
I'd say the fact that we exist, baryons, right? So no doubt that we exist, and and basically that means at some level, baryon number was violated in the early universe, or you know, and we don't to this day know what that what really caused it. And put on decay, yeah, and CP violation, things like that.
Is the inflaton? I mean, does that happen too? Is inflation happen too early for that to be a part of inflation? Or
well, I mean, you could try to create baryon number, I suppose, by doing reheating. I don't know if there are models and I guess there are models like that.
Yeah, people have tried. Yeah, that's a great idea. People have done this.
Oh.
They inflate. I mean, you can have a baryon carry baryon number, or you can have some other particle that decays during the time of when the inflaton decays as well.
I mean, there are definitely models like that out there, but you know, in general, if you ask the question, it's like, why is the proton stable? Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a kind of a weird thing, because as far as we know, there's baryon number symmetry that protects
mm-hmm.
it. It's not a gate symmetry. There are very reasonable reasons to think that in quantum gravity or whatever, gate symmetry, I mean, things that are global symmetries won't be protected. It's a reasonable expectation.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think sort of, I would certainly say finding new ways to go for proton decay is definitely a very important goal.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I've always asked people, is it possible that just the initial conditions were that there's more baryon than anti-baryon, and people always say that inflation like make sure that's not the case.
No, but it's like after inflation, you can reheat. You know, so there are models like that where it's called Affleck Dyke or whatever. There's this field with a certain value, and that picks better.
So is it possible?
It's possible.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's no problem.
All right. Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of, I remember this talk by Nima Akarni Hamid once where I remember he was introducing, so I think it was one of these large extra dimensions talks, and he's, you know, going through all the experimental constraints that it fits, and he said, you know, he's like, well, there's only one problem with this theory is that the proton decays very quickly, but that's not a problem because that's everybody's theory's problem. So, you know, I shouldn't discard it because of that. So, I don't know, maybe we'll move on. Okay, next question. Okay, now getting more optimistic, we move toward, is there motivation for non-gravitational interaction of dark matter, dark energy with a standard model of particles and fields? I mean, is there anything that suggests that it should from cosmological measurements, astrophysical measurements? Like,
yeah,
what's
the abundance of dark matter? It had to be produced somehow. So some way it should couple to something that also produced us, at least, you know, through the inflaton.
Uh-huh.
You can avoid it.
X squared, pi squared. It's the same thing that can give you inflation and also give you dark matter, right?
Right.
A light, very light field. It doesn't interact with us at all.
You can't avoid it. I'm not saying it's a proof.
Yeah. So
let's put it this way: we have models like SLIMS and so on, where you can sort of add a credible piece into the story. That's how the abundance came about, right? You kind of concentrate on these models, but you could have really nightmarish models with the scalar and this, you know.
There's nothing you can do. I mean, in principle, only that's it's
no.
It's like actually dark matter, but
non-interacting. Yes, clearly. No.
Question is not.
Yes.
The question is it motivated? Yes.
Clearly
motivated.
It's clearly
motivated.
Yes.
All right.
Dark energy is less obvious.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Yeah. So is dark energy a legit name?
Right.
Yeah, that's the first question.
Yes,
right.
So another question that I think came up several times was kind of narrowing in again. Okay, so it's looking, now we're getting more optimistic. So this question of technical naturalness and, you know, I know that Raman said, hey, oh, every time somebody says that word, everybody should go, psst, right? So maybe, I don't know, maybe if we could, but is that something that we just really shouldn't be overly concerned with as experimentalists when we go out to decide what to do, or is it something we should, you know, think about as a guide?
It's more or less like a cost-based thing, right? So I would say if you have to spend $100 billion to go after something that is technically very unnatural, I'm like, well, maybe we should probably do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But for a small-scale experiment, you know, definitely you shouldn't be too concerned about it.
Well, the time that you will be spending, right? So.
No. But it's, and the thing is, we have evidence in the world that are certainly very unnatural scales, right? So it's not like this is the that you know, the cosmological constant, exactly something which is technically very unnatural, just happens to be true. So was it worth finding that out? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, people are going to spend billions on measuring W away or not away from minus
mm-hmm.
one, right?
Right.
So,
that's a highly unnatural.
Right.
And
not just 1 billion, right?
I said hundreds of billions. Exactly.
You got a high budget. So, you know, another topic came up a lot. Okay, now, of course, also, please keep in mind, this might be a little biased towards things that the theory folks know very well and the experimentalists don't know as well. So please feel free to flip it on side and if you find something. But, you know, so there's a lot of discussion about the hierarchy problem, the observed Higgs mass, the cosmological constant scale, the bicep 2 results, the Planck scale. And, you know, so, and of course, everybody draws these exclusion parameter plots and things like this. And I guess, you know, is there a take-home message for experimentalists on, I guess, the scale of the new physics where we should be aiming for? You know, certainly, I think one thing that was kind of exciting, I think this is in a later slide too, but kind of exciting new idea, at least, I don't know if it's new, maybe it's an old idea, but that I wasn't, you know, it was kind of new to me, was this focus on maybe variation of constants at this faster rate, which seemed to be more natural, maybe better motivated. I don't know, but is there any more discussion about the energy scales that are of particular interest?
Well, bicep 2 thing is in transition, right? Or
yeah.
About a year or two, we will know for sure if R is equal to 0.1, right?
Mm-hmm.
Much more likely than not, right? That if we will have an answer.
More likely than not that we will know.
We will know.
We will. If it's 0.01, right, then we might never know, right?
Well, yes.
The claims made by bicep will become scrutinized more and checked, right? That will may point to a high-scale insulation as initial results do, right? In which case there are, you know, profound implications for physics.
All right. Okay, let's... here's an experiment question, maybe. So this new idea of searching for the fast varying constants, I guess the question...
Fast meaning not with the lifetime of the universe.
Right, something more like this, you know, high frequency variations of the fundamental constants. Yeah.
Actually, in principle, it can, because but I don't want to say about constants now. I want to say something even more interesting. The nightmare scenario, square pi square. Then it's an interesting paper that was written a few months ago in September by Rubakov that said, the reason we were motivated the other day, me and Maxim, the oscillating is because of dark matter, right? The same when you're looking for the axion wind that's oscillating. If you have a scalar field, it will always have this oscillation of the period of its mass. If it has the scalar coupling, or what is called the dilaton coupling, you see this oscillation in the fundamental constants. Turns out even the gravitational coupling gives such an oscillation. There is a pressure term in the energy momentum tensor. The TII component of the energy momentum tensor of dark matter can be oscillating to the tiny frequency. The amplitude can be very small, unless the wavelength of dark matter. So imagine the gravitational field of dark matter in the galaxy is of order 10 to the minus 6, which is a very big thing. So imagine that whole thing was oscillating.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge effect.
Yeah, yeah.
Turns out, though, that in reality, because in what you observe, the potential is the is the fact this is the theory of the dark matter, sine and cosine adds, so you get one, so there's no oscillation. So the thing that oscillates is the pressure term, TII. So that term goes, what does that do? If you have, let's say, a very precise atomic clock somewhere in the sky, then if you were to send, and we were very far away from it, what you would see is the frequency of the oscillation vibrate with time. This is also, those clocks are known as millisecond pulsars.
Well, if there is no interaction, you send...
This is the gravitational.
Gravitational.
This is the gravitational time delay. So this is something that, so for cosmological scales, this effect is, I mean, now, okay, what is the size of the effect? The problem with millisecond pulses is that they're relatively close to us, so they are at 1 kiloparsec. So they don't probe the whole gravitational field of the galaxy. So the effect they try to look for is, instead of 10 to the minus 6, it's additionally suppressed because it's a pressure by velocity squared, so it's a 10 to the minus 12. Because it's also a shorter distance, turns out it's at the level of 10 to the minus 15, which is at the limit for one particular mass of what millisecond pulsar array can do. Now the question is, for example, if you were to put very precise atomic clocks somewhere in orbit in the solar system, could you do some similar experiment? So that's another thing in oscillation. So this is something, this is, yes, you can look at the physical spectroscopy search for variations of atomic constants, but you can also look for pure gravity, which is also pretty cool.
And so, I mean, that's kind of interesting too, because that goes back to this thing, like in the most pessimistic, one of the most pessimistic scenarios, that's something that should be out there.
So
a clock close to the Earth is going to be useful in that regard, or you have to send your clock?
I don't know. I mean, I forgot to ask you guys, because I thought about it a bit. So everything that we came up, we thought that the size, because the size signal reduces as the signal size reduces as the size of dark matter, as the dark matter mass squared. So the heavier you make the mass, meaning the quantum wavelength of the dark matter reduces, the signal size logarithm goes like the mass squared. So every simple thing we try to do with atomic clocks or gravitational wave detectors in space was not given an observable answer. But the question is, for example, if you were to take two clocks in space, how far away could you put them and still have the sensitivity that you guys were presenting today? I mean, in principle, you could also detect gravitational waves with this. But this is something for, some thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, that might be a $1 billion project, right? Your budget scale?
Oh, that's fine. Yeah. I'm all in favor of putting clocks in space and connecting them together.
Wow, cool. All right. So something came up during the discussions about trying to get around some of these problems. I think it might have came up in the BICEP 2 discussion about maybe that pushes some energy scales to a pessimistic place, but okay, you can get around them if there's some, rolling of coupling constants in some sort of way. And somebody pointed out that, something could happen is a phase transition process with the couplings. So just to being naive, is this, could there be tiny, small effect phase transitions that occur that, maybe more frequently than like once in the early universe could be like, and something, I don't know. So then going, of course, back to, being somewhat self-centered as maybe we all are to some degree, I think, maybe that's something that you could see in GNOME or a clock network or what do you think? So some transient effect of something
chain
weird.
A of phase transitions was once invoked as a solution
oh my god, we have both potentials.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Oh, see, there we go.
Yeah. Didn't go very far.
Well, what's old is new, right? Green is the new black, right? So, all right.
All right, okay. I'll just toss that out there. So, I don't know. We can look up the reference.
Go out like domains of slightly different coupling constants is not unthinkable. Right? I mean, like the scalar field that interpolates between the two domains doesn't have to be 10^-42 GeV, right? It can be much heavier in that sense, in a more natural system. So part of the, you know, if I go back to this Australian dipole and I don't plot it in a sort of R times cosine theta or whatever variables, right? But you just plot south versus north, right? There are two blocks of data, right? And so one could, you know, put a step function through it, right? So it could be a domain wall passing through somewhere, right? With the, I mean, it's not a very solid suggestion, but maybe not. I mean, much worse than the dark, right? So it's a possibility.
Okay. Yep.
So, Maxime, then if it were the case, then when would the wall pass through us?
wait another billion years.
There's just one.
Wow. Yeah, so you have to ask for a billion years of funding?
So here's an idea. You know, if, suppose you have a slight change in the mass of the neutron and the proton, right? Mm-hmm. And suppose it allows some nuclear transition, which is normally forbidden.
Oh.
And so there is this, you know, a focal nuclear reactor where you can look at the isotopes of the leftover and see if there's a variation of little constants. So, you know, it's a very naive thing. If you take a piece of diamond and you find that it's, you know, some atoms of carbon decayed in some time ago, you know, because the wall passed through it. You know, that's one way I can imagine thinking, you know, looking for some sort of
chemical signature of something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so creation of a natural isotope which is, you know, that governed by some kind of nuclear effect, threshold effect.
It has to be a strong change, right? Because if it's a short-term relation effect, it has to affect the abundances on that time scale.
So maybe you have a lot of atoms in your sample, so that helps, you know, if you just...
Well, if something is stable initially, and then, you know, it becomes like a radioactive nuclear with a lifetime of a few minutes, and so maybe it will decay, or some few atoms will decay, or something like that.
If proton becomes heavier than neutron.
Yeah.
To have an observable signal doesn't have to be, because tritium and helium-3 plus electron are different by like a few, say, 18 kV or so, right? So if you change you know, masses by even 100 kV, you get to the stage when, you know, helium-3 would like to capture an electron and become tritium. And the mass is still working on this process. And then you can get the signature from decay back. And,
That's good. So maybe this is where maybe we've exhausted our discussion of bicep 2 results. I don't know if there's anything more to say. We had a good. All right. No objections. All right. Okay. All right. So I think another important question we talked about a lot is. The relation between astrophysical and laboratory searches. So this idea that, you know, there's these extremely strict astrophysical bounds from different mechanisms, and then there's these laboratory searches, and you know, I guess, but there's ways around it, as we pointed out with these chameleon fields, and so I guess, you know, I mean, I think, you know, it's certainly. We should all take, I mean, the point of doing the astrophysical constraints is to take them, you know, at face value. But then, you know, I guess the question is kind of at the second level, are there ones that we should take more seriously than other ones in terms of the ability of new physics to get around them? Or, you know, is there any, you know, I guess, is there some, I was going to open up that for discussion in terms of the strictness and less strictness of the laboratory and astrophysical.
The community went through this exercise when this wrong results by
What's the name of
this? PVLS.
PVLS, claim, right? Because it's sort of
lower.
A lot of, well, not exactly light shining through the wall, but similar kind of idea, experiment, but was claimed to have positive detection that would be describable tentatively by an axiom with the coupling constant 10 to the 6 GeV rather than, you know, which would shorten the lifetime of the sun by, you know, a million times, right? So it should have not exist by now, right? And so people went through the exercise of building extremely baroque models where you can get away from these constraints, where density, you know, changes everything and becomes like a chameleon and so on. When you're doing this, like I said, then you go from like natural model to not directly to like a natural model, but really baroque model, right? So the you know, it may happen, but this type of models are not going to be your primary target.
Sure.
Okay? So in the sense that if suddenly you know, have an unmistakable signature of new spin-spin interaction that is, you know, suddenly well deep inside this stellar region or exclusion region, then we have to rethink it, right? But not before that.
Right, right, right. All right, good. I think even in talks today, some of this was addressed a little bit. You know, I think in the excellent theory talk at the end, when they talk about possibilities of more than one axion and how that changes things. One question was about the state of knowledge between the coupling between dark matter particles. There was some discussion of this, I think, at some point that, you know, they can't couple too strongly, but they can't couple too weakly. But then another kind of a way around that was brought up is, well, maybe, you know, maybe if dark matter is more complex, maybe you could have like 5% of the dark matter that's strongly coupled and 95% that's weakly coupled, and 5% of the dark matter is still a lot of dark matter, and maybe you get crazy interesting things, you know, like somebody, I heard a shot from the back, axion stars, and, you know, and then, you know, of course, my light bulb went off again. I'm like, no, we'll be looking for, you know, light shining from the axion stars. I don't know.
In fact, Lisa Randall has just proposed how to explain how the dinosaurs died. I'm curious.
That's awesome. So GNOME is necessary to give us a warning when the axion starts coming, and we gotta, you know, okay, all right. Gotta blast it with, I don't know, CP violating matter to shoot out. Okay, so, all right, that's interesting. So,
there are bounds on the self-scattering of dark matter. This comes from observations of the bullet cluster, things like that, where we, you know, see dark matter kind of went through. But of course, those are all on like 100% of the dark matter, right? So if a small sub-fraction of it was scattering, there's no current bound on that.
Or as you know, if it's clumped into very large objects.
Very large objects, exactly. Yeah, so it all depends upon like sigma over m, right? If all the dark matter is one particle, obviously you don't see it.
Right,
right. So the bound cross section over mass, probably.
I mean, naively,
But the bound,
you know, it seems like assuming that, I mean, sure, Occam's razor, dark matter is all one thing, seems, you know, all right, but it seems not that implausible that it's more than one thing to me, but I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sure. So, for a smaller fraction of dark matter, it could be pretty complex. You know? Mm-hmm. Or if it's all a large blob, it could be very complex, and there are presently no ways that we know.
Okay.
But it could go through. No.
Right. Yeah, that's what I like to hear. All right. Now we're talking. I guess maybe this first question we've just been talking about, and I know people are working on it. Maybe I'll leave that as a take-home problem. So keep thinking about it. But I think it's actually, I mean, you know, when this conference was very nascent, I think it was motivated by the conference organizers all had some connection to these projects, and we wanted to try to generate more ideas. And I think that's definitely been successful. So
I think there's definitely some new ideas being generated, which is exciting. So, this seems to be a big problem for this initial proposal. Is there anything at all that can be said about, you know, more plausible or less plausible scales of domains?
Less plausible, but then you tons less plausible. You want more plausible. If you want to detect.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, even with domain walls, by the way, I mean, there are models where you get one domain wall per Hubble, and that's extremely reasonable. And then your chance of actually going through you is pretty easy.
That's not to be a wall, right? Yeah, it can be a monopole. That model, you know, great.
No, you can.
I mean, dark matter out of walls, that may be.
By the way,
you can build a house out of it.
No, but
it's actually more challenging.
You can, but there are still constraints, right? Because you still need the monopole to have some coupling to us.
Yes.
Right? Oh, you want to have the pi square something?
Didn't you write down coupling with pi?
No, we
mixing,
did. Yes,
so
we did.
So
but it's actually quite constrained. Because there is the Parker bound, right? Even those are a bit constrained.
No, but you didn't get the true monopole. It's not a true monopole. So, sorry. No Parker bound.
All right. Maybe we'll leave that as an open question.
No, there are many monopoles.
Yeah. Maybe that one single domain wall in the... will help the Cubs win the World Series.
But now we're not talking about probabilities, you know. Like it seems like Maxime is saying that monopoles are more probable than balls.
It's
right.
You know, it will behave exactly the same as the Wimp dark matter. And if I have enough initial abundance, it will clump the same way as the Wimp dark matter or any other axion dark matter as a cold dark matter. Right. So in that sense. One doesn't have to be inventive as to how the structure forms, because people know how the structure forms out of, you know, zero-dimensional objects, so to speak, from, because, you know, large point, distance point of view, right? Because it just collapses as Newtonian interacting particles.
Agreed. But then, I mean, suppose a monopole is supposed to be... Well, at least the vector field, yeah? So,
monopole has to have at least some dark non-abelian group that you can form, right? Then, there are names, different monopole is used in many different instances, right? I'm using it just to specify that it's an extended object
in zero dimension. Somehow write a some type of an axion coupling for monopoles, because now you have
in a gradient of the density of the monopole could potentially couple to the spin, right? So
then you are going to have a square of the field, right?
Well, we're talking about dark matter now, right? For dark matter, it's an okay thing. Now you want this also to interact with something, right? Okay. With your detector. That's a next level question.
By the way, there's also for GNOME, you guys also consider monopoles and strings, right? I mean, they can just be very big.
I don't see why not.
Yeah.
How big is this monopole?
It could easily be the size of the Earth. I can write down such a model. If you're already writing 100 meters, it's pretty much the same. But,
oh, wow.
So they could easily pass through all the detectors.
That's awesome. All right.
And it's not weighing the Earth much.
Yeah.
It's relative to the light object, right?
And what is the density?
Dark matter density, if it's
you have to make it right. So for monopoles, I don't know how you get the right abundance. You still get one per Hubble when they are first created, and then
it can be much more than that. It's you're at least guaranteed one per Hubble, but you can certainly do more.
Yeah, that's true, but then they annihilate, right? The question is how many monopoles are there? Monopoles you get, they're still annihilated, so you have to care.
There are monopoles, and there are, as we know, zero-dimensional, non-topological solitons called q-balls.
Oh,
whose,
yeah.
Whose abundance is
that's
regulated
true.
By one extra parameter, right? The overall charge.
That's true.
So, you know, so options.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I also heard mention a couple of times, although maybe it was by the same person, about higher dimension topological defects and something called textures, but I didn't catch what that was. Is that also something of interest?
I don't know about textures.
We should get our director. He used to write papers
and
textures.
Okay, all right. Oh, yeah. Also, I heard that the photon mass could be altered inside a topological defect, and is that one of the signatures that all of these networks are sensitive to, or is that a different signature than other?
It's like if you take a superconductor and create a vortex, abrigosa vortex, you can think of the photon mass. As you go through the vortex changes, right? So you can have the very same effect in the dark sector. And if there is a mixing between the normal photon and the dark photon, as you go through the center of the vortex, your effective electromagnetic strength changes. So it can lead to observable effects very easily.
All right, okay, so I guess importantly, I have to get to my advisor's questions, which he posed at the beginning of the conference. So I remember one of Dima's questions originally was symmetry tests of gravity. The question was, how might we test if, as I interpreted the question, standard gravity, so we have these tests that are looking for spin gravity interactions that are P and T violating, but that's clearly some model of gravity beyond the gravity we know about. So is there a way for that to violate some discrete symmetries and be able to test them with some sort of laboratory experiment? So it was mentioned gravitomagnetic fields and some chirality and gravitational waves, both of which might talk to this effect. And a follow-up question would be, these experiments that measure big G, the torsion pendulum experiments or atom interferometer experiments. Could you configure those in some sort of geometry where you could see if something changes based on mirror symmetry or
The most reasonable question in this, can we ever see this spin dot little G coupling, right? Which you would get out of the scale. This would be P and T odd interaction, and this is the most reasonable question in this field, right? And as far as I know, the best limits so far are coming from now maybe 30-year-old experiment, 20-year-old experiment of comparing two species of mercury in at University of Washington. So it would be nice to improve on that by some way.
Man, I don't believe anybody's ever said that the experiment I'm working on is asking the most reasonable question in the field. That's weird.
Gravity, I think this is like what's more fundamental than little g, right?
Yeah.
And it's a vector, it can couple to S, right? So if there is a component, I mean, it's a tensor field, then it's difficult to do, right? But if it's a gradient of the scalar, there is a scalar component, then it's
Should the coupling be proportional to the mass or not?
No. So if you have S dot G vector, right, then one part, it's like axion mass coupling, right? So one part is going to be proportional to the mass, another one not.
Thanks.
Can I respond in a provocative way to what you just
Norman Ramsey in 19, I don't remember what it was, decided to measure neutron EDM as a way to look for parity violation.
Right, yes.
And that was a bad way to look for parity violation, arguably. It was a great way to look for T violation, PNP violation. Right? So aren't you proposing sort of something analogous to what you need? I mean, you want to like jump the gun here and violate everything at the same time. As Lesho says, you can go and violate everything.
I'm trying to come up with M level that will do that, right? And this would be not the model of slapping in some high dimensional curvature blob big 10 derivative operator. It's the most natural thing to have in the scale of tensor theory of gravity. Now you can have a vector component to a gravity, right, and start putting in some couplings, axial, vector and axial. At this point, it's already becoming a slightly weird discussion. Why is it we call it gravity anyways, right?
So this measurement of a big G, you know, someone had kind of plotted it, right? And they're all inconsistent with respect to each other by, you know, many sigma. And of course, everyone thinks, well, it's an experimental problem. And of course, the equivalence principle has been tested to much better accuracy than that. But the question is, you know, if there is some crazy theory where, you know, people measure G in slightly different way and then somehow give you a signal, you know, it's real. Because
I personally think that the error bars were over course from
well, that's the most likely explanation, of course, I agree. But you know, a couple of crazy things and you know, kind of signal.
Well, maybe we should we're a little over time, so maybe we should take our coffee break, and we have I have a lot more questions on my slides, but then maybe people can think about more questions, because we have, I think after the coffee break, we have 2 hours of open mic session. So
returning back here?
I believe so. Yeah. I guess at 4 or a little after 4, if that's good for everyone. All right. See you in a bit.